Having gone through these first two stages, destroy the inn, humiliate and beat up the tax collectors, the third step was a kind of celebration. Having won a signal victory against the forces of evil, the peasants would then confiscate the barrels of wine. It was helpful to have broken into the inn beforehand. The wine would then be rolled out into the street. The peasants would drink themselves silly under a truly carnivalesque atmosphere. And very often, that would actually be the end of the revolt. Nonetheless, in times of extreme hardship, unrest actually could spread from one village to another like wildfire, from district to district, until an entire province would be engulfed by a revolt of the common people. As I've said before, however, the end of these revolts was as predictable as the course of the uprising itself, because eventually the forces of authority would arrive. If the peasants were still in arms, if there still were peasant regiments in any kind of formal organization, they would almost invariably be defeated in a battle. It was usually a savage battle, but it was also usually a fairly brief one. So the peasants could not stand up to professional soldiers by the middle of the 17th century. But more common than having these peasant revolts end in an actual clash of arms, the peasants, being fairly sensible about this kind of thing, would already have left the scene. They might have, having dissipated their anger against the inn, against the excisemen, and having ventilated with a little alcohol, perhaps having attacked a fortress or two for good measure, or perhaps quite simply just because of the lateness of the season. The crops had to be brought in, the family had to be tended to. The peasants might already have melted away into the forests by the time the royal troops arrived. Now, going along with the ritualized nature of these rebellions, there had to be some kind of retribution. Some people had to be judged guilty as being ringleaders of the revolt, and they usually had to be executed. But the actual death toll was usually quite small. Just to give you one example, after the revolt of the Croquants between 1637 and 1641, this huge uprising of 30,000 peasants in southwestern France, barely a dozen people would be in the end put to death by the crown. Most of the time, the crown would tidy matters up by issuing an amnesty after a few people had been executed for the sake of example, and although it seems, having related their normal course in this way, it probably seems like these revolts were utterly pointless, it should be emphasized that they often did produce very real gains for the French peasantry. Several months after the revolt, once the kind of sting of it had faded a bit, the crimes it had involved were usually pardoned by the authorities. The most bitterly resented levies might often actually be repealed. And above all, and I think this is a crucial point which shouldn't be overlooked, tax collection itself, as an administrative process, would be massively disrupted by these revolts, so that even if, in a formal sense, the peasants didn't get a tax revoked or canceled in some sense, the practical reality that taxes could not be collected while there were tens of thousands of men under arms rampaging through the districts meant that it did actually give the peasants genuine material relief from the burdens of the French crown. Having sketched the normal course, the events of a peasant revolt in that way, I'd like now to turn to its ideology, the typical ideology of a peasant revolt. This is a subject which is harder to investigate than is the case with the judges or with the princes, because peasants, most of whom were illiterate, didn't provide or generate as many documents. But there are nonetheless several peasant manifestos which have survived from the revolts of the mid-17th century, and what they reflect is a fundamentally conservative outlook on the part of the rural masses, and indeed a conservative outlook which was often pervaded by all kinds of interesting myths or imaginations. Never did the peasantry ever challenge the legitimacy of the monarchy per se. It was instead widely believed that the king had been deceived by his wicked advisors, who concealed for him the excruciating sufferings of his subjects. It was often felt that the king was being robbed by finance ministers who pillaged the treasury. And it was therefore felt that if only the king could be apprised of the sufferings of his poor people, he would himself certainly condone the uprisings. Now, it is easy to look on this as a kind of political naivete. The peasants are so silly, they think that, you know, that the king doesn't know what's happening to them and it's only his wicked advisors. I think it is worth stressing, however, that we can also read this as a kind of political realism, because after all, it was quite common in aristocratic risings as well to say, we're not resisting the king, we're just going after his bad advisors. It was a politically safer thing to do, and I think it's entirely likely that the peasants caught on to this strategy as well and very shrewdly framed their demands in ways which were seen as less subversive than if they'd said, down with the king, we all want to live in little communes. Another interesting feature of the ideology of peasant revolt was the rumor that taxation would end altogether. Peasants would have this idea as often that the taxes of the monarchy were only temporary levies, they were expedients of some kind which one day would cease, and the idea that taxes were about to end was particularly strong in years when war itself came to a conclusion or if a king died. It was often rumored that the king would remit taxes. In fact, some peasants even seemed to believe that the king might repay taxes to his subjects on his deathbed or something like this.